leader. So feel free to come and, you know, take part in the, well, I was supposed to also remind you that they, before we start, and if, I might take a break partway through that, an hour and a half, the food that's out here in the bistro, you feel free to take, because it's just kind of generally available. And there's also in the kitchen on the front end on the third floor, there's also drinks at various times. So feel free to take those too. So if you have to be here before you might have them. That's just generally there for your refreshment. So I'm here next week. So I mean, probably, unless there's an overwhelming demand, you should cancel the bands for the universities. So just, you know, I'll try to, and if you know anyone who's not here, I'll try to email around, but some kind of thing that might not, they haven't yet got me the electronic version of the list that you guys all signed up for. So spread the word if you can, not to come next week. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
Well, since you're not going to be here next week, does that mean we're not going to, we're definitely not going to get a bomb second for 2 weeks? What are you going to give them today?
I can give it to you pretty much any time. It helps though that I just have it, helps this PDF comes because it has problems in the PDF. I just kind of be telling which one to which. So it doesn't have to be when you're here, but yeah, I can give those to you electronically. Okay. Any other questions?
Do you know how, like, bomb production will last?
Oh, how close to Christmas? I'm not completely sure. I'm kind of trying to bail the exam periods when they start, because you guys will have other obligations then. And I don't know when the exam period started, so.
It's probably different for people.
So what is it for McMaster, say? What is it for Waterloo then?
I think it's on the last class. Yeah, the
last case is the
5th.
Okay. And how about the Western? So we kind of aim to maybe stop at the maybe December the 13th is a Wednesday. So that means that the 6th is a Wednesday. So maybe the 6th could be the last lecture. I think we have to close it off.
Doesn't give us a lot of time.
Yeah.
Is it possible, concern?
Is it possible to
learn? I'm also concerned with, you only have a month and a half then?
Oh, so we're going to go like.
All right.
We're going to go like the wind. Yeah, I used to just teach this in one term, and it's, so I think I'm in two terms, we'll get what we get. So. All right, any other questions? So I gave you the song and dance about what do you like the theory look like. Let's look at free field theory. And basically the point of this section now is that you know what a non-interacting Hamiltonian looks like in terms of creation annihilation operators. But you know that you're looking for an expression of things that are local in space and time, and the creation annihilation operators are not, because they're labeled by momentum. So that motivated that we wanted to make the Hamiltonian as the integral d3x or something. And actually what we really wanted to do was make a Lagrangian as the integral d3x or something. Because the Lagrangian was nicer because the integral Lagrangian was the action that was something that we wanted to be a Lorentzian. Whereas the Hamiltonian was uglier than the point of the Lorentzian transformation. And this thing we want to depend on various fields and possibly the derivatives and so on. And the fields were related to the creation of annihilation operators by some Fourier transform, so that it's integral d3p of EGI, dx, p sigma. And if there's more than one field, then let's say we have, I'll use a p, so we've got more than one kind of particle. P dot x here means, you know, p mu x mu, which means minus P0, X0, plus P dot X, so that's minus the energy times time, plus P dot X. And then there are some coefficients that I'm not writing down here yet, but there'll be some over the spins, the first spins. So then we had this, and then I kind of argued in some animating fashion that this was not the whole story. If you try to build this, the problem was that one of the things you would like is for this thing to commute with itself when evaluated at different space, like space, at different points that are space like separated. And the thing is that these things don't. If you have five and five star, you know what the A's and A stars do to each other. And so you just repeat how these things commute and they don't. And so that was the problem. So the resolution was we were thinking there was a Fermi particle and an antiparticle, possibly the same as the particle. And we were supposed to add to this the complex conjugate. So we had the term like e to the minus I, dx, dr, with some coefficients. Now, so what I want to do now is talk more about the coefficients. And what the Lagrangian will look like for free fields where you know what the answer looks like in terms of the A stars. Now the coefficients are a little bit dependent. They depend on in the spin in particular. So typically there'll be a coefficient here. Let's call it U of U of P and sigma. And this is typically called phi of P and sigma. And what I haven't told you is what the U's and V's are. So the question is, and the answer, the general statement is known, and I just want to just tell you what it is, and then tell you where to look it up, because I'm not going to derive it. I'm going to approach it in a slightly different way. But one way of thinking about this is, what you're asking is, if you hand me a field, so this field is might be a scalar field, might be a, you know, this might be a spinner field, might be a vector field, but it's going to transform in some way into Lorentz transformations. And this particle has some sort of spin and momentum, and those are labels of states which transform under Lorentz transformations in a specific way. The main message is that the fields transform under Lorentz transformations in a way which is finite dimensional, because you want to have a finite number of fields. Whereas the particles transform under Lorentz transformations in a way which is unitary, because that's in the quantum system, symmetries are described by unitary or anti-unitary transformations. And it's a theorem that for Lorentz transformations, all of the unitary representations are infinite dimensional. And so what you know is that the transformation properties of this have to be different than the transformation properties of these guys. So under Lorentz transformations, and Poincaré transformations, you know, you've got some unitary operator in the quantum mechanics which satisfies that U of phi A of X. Let me give it two labels. So let's say this is counting the, this is counting, say, the number of the different kinds of particles. And I've given an index I here, which is might be a spinner label or might be a vector label or something else. And if that's the case, then I give these U's carry the Lorentz label of the fields, whereas the different kinds of particles, so this might be an electron as opposed to a muon as opposed to a tau particle, that's the thing that's labeled particle takes carriage. And Lorentz transformation did it, that so this U star will transform as some matrix Dij times phi j a of the Lorentz transform x. And this is a finite dimensional and it's finite dimensional because you want to have some finite number of fields. Now the so for particles you know that you know U on P sigma is something involving P and sigma, so if we some other matrix, call it curly P, sigma, sigma prime, and I'm not going to be worried about where it is. And that says that the, you know, U from the destruction operator is the same kind of thing. It might not be exactly the matrix. Probably it's exactly the matrix. And the point is that these guys are unitary and infinite dimensional. dimensional. Interdimensional because, you know, the rows and columns are labeled by momentum. So that's got that. There's lots of momentum up here to have. So the problem of finding out what the U's and V's are is a classic Clebsch-Gordan group theory problem. You've got one kind of representation, you're trying to write it as the sum of another kind of representation, and group theory tells you what the coefficients are. Now, if we had had a spin, supposing we had a spin a half times a spin a half state, if we had a two-particle state called two spins a half, that's a spin one or a spin zero, and there's a specific linear combination of all the various combinations of spin a half products, which gives you spin zero or spin one. And the coefficients are Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, and they're determined by group theory. And same thing's true here. You tell me how the field transforms, you tell me how the particle transforms, which is to say you tell me its spin, then I can tell you what these U's and V's are after caramelization just using the group theory of Lorentz group. So that's a solved problem. So the claim is the U's and the V's are fixed up to normalization. And that tells you in particular which fields can represent particles of which spin. And if you have me a field, which kinds of spins can I represent? And the answer is depends on whether the particle's massless or not. And that's some interesting surprises in the way you're probably expecting. So I'm going to talk mostly about the spin one, the spin zero, and the spin a half cases. And it's only in the spin one case that you start to see really interesting things change depending on whether the particle's massless or not. Being massless is relevant because these matrices depend in detail on whether or not the particles are massive or not. And so the answer you get depends on whether the particle is massive or not. And so this is given in Weinberg's volume. This is another one of those things which is there and almost nowhere else. It turns out that there's for a particle of a given spin, who knows what the representation of Lorentz group? Because I can kind of say what the answer is, but it's going to be useless if you don't know what the representation is. So the finite dimensional representation of Lorentz group, I mean, they're often labeled in terms of you can label finite dimensional representations in terms of two SU2 labels. So you can label them an A and an A, a little A, a B, and a little B, where A minus capital A. Where little a is equal to minus capital A plus 1, up to A minus 1, and A, and the same thing for B. So these are very much like SU2 labels. So you can label finite dimensional representations in terms of pairs of spins. And does that mean anything to anybody? Who's seen that kind of representation? It's not many people. Let me just make a statement that reason aside. So in this language, a scalar would be zero, zero. It's two spinless things. A left-handed spinner is a one-half, zero, and a right-handed spinner is zero, one-half. A four-vector is a one-half, one-half. A skewed tensor is a one, zero, or zero, one, depending if it's self-dual or self-dual, and so on. And the statement is, so these two numbers are the, I'm telling you A or B, and they can take, you know, 0, half, 1, anything that would be allowed to have for a spin. And the statement is that for massive particles of spin J, the solution to this problem says that you're allowed to use fields for which A and B satisfy that A minus B absolute value is less than J or equal to J, less than equal to A plus B. And for massless, plus B, plus B, S, the solution is that A minus B has to be equal to S. And then you can just write down what these things are as functions of effect. And I got to tell you this partly because it tells you things you expect. So if we wanted a spinless particle, then we can always represent that by a scalar field. So if A and B are 0 and J is 0, that works in all cases. You could also use a vector field, a half-half, because a half-half satisfies that if J is 0. And that corresponds to thinking a vector field as the gradient of a scalar field. And that's the way it plays out, is that all the various different choices you have for the fields basically correspond to taking derivatives of the basic one. And the smallest one is the one that's most useful. And for a spinless particle, that's typically a scalar field. If you have a spin-half particle, then the simplest fields are the left and right-handed spinners. For a spin-1 particle that's massive, then you can use a 4-vector. But for a massless spin-1 particle, if S was 1, you can't have A and B both be a half. And so one of the surprises is that you cannot describe a massless spin-1 particle by a vector field. And you might think, well, I do it all the time. It's the electromagnetic potential. And the thing is that the electromagnetic potential is actually not a 4-vector. It's a 4-vector up to a gauge transformation. The thing that could be led to here would be a 1, 0, and a 0, 1 is a simple thing to describe a massless spin-1 field particle. And that's the electromagnetic field strength, F mu. And one of them describes the velocity 1, and one of them describes velocity minus 1. And so, for G massless spin 1, S equals plus or minus 1 leads normally to 1, 0, 0, 1, which is normally a thing of mu. That's the density that you're left with. And not. But it turns out that if you actually ask what these U's and V's are in that case, it turns out that F is the pluralism. So it turns out that this turns out to be d mu of A mu minus d mu of A mu for some A. Isn't that a paradox? It's not a paradox because the resulting A that you get is not a 4-vector. It's a 4-vector up to a gradient. So A satisfies that U A mu U star is equal to lambda mu nu A mu 4-vector plus the derivative of something. For some omega. And so that's why gauge invariance has to be there. If you want to describe a massless spin 1 particle in a way which does not involve derivatives, this involves derivatives, so something which is surviving in the static limit, like the Coulomb potential, say, you're forced to do it if you want to do it in a Lorentz invariant way, in a way which preserves the symmetry under the shift. And so it's often presented to you that gauge invariance is the gauge principle is something you have to assume when you're deciding how to think about how things interact, and it's going to play a huge role in the standard model. And that's not really the right way to think about it. The gauge principle is a derived thing, not a separate assumption. It's a consequence of unitarity and Lorentz invariance. Yeah?
Why? Doesn't it make sense to then just formulate so
you could. But then you would never get any interactions which were, you would never get a Coulomb interaction, which is a static interaction that doesn't vanish when no one's moving. And so if you want to describe things which are static, as well as spin involving Coulomb particles, then you're forced to do it in a gauge invariant way. But magnetic moments, you do perfectly well in developing exactly that thing.
So then the description in terms of the gauge field is just richer than the description in terms of the field?
Yeah. There are things you can do with gauge field you cannot do with that thing in a local way. And if you did the same thing for spin 2, massless spin 2, supposing you're just hypothetically interested in that, then the same thing, you're left to essentially the 2, 0 plus 0, 2, which is the Bowles metric, and not the metric. The metric would have been a 1, 1, which is not a metric. And the same argument says that if you want to describe, if you don't care about static interactions, then that's fine. But if you want to, like Newton's law, then you're forced to do it in terms of the same kind of argument, something involving it's a tensor in that case, which is the metric fluctuation. But it's got to come with a gauge invariance in order to do the job of describing the masses in two logic. So gauge, the message there, which I'm just alluding to because it's important to know about it, but it's not really. That's a field theory course, and that's a Hadamard course, and again, that's all I'll remember, that gauge invariance is something which is not an option. Giving up gauge invariance is like giving up Lorentz invariance or unitarity. And so if you're experimenting and giving up gauge invariance, know the price you're paying, it might be worth it. Maybe you want to give up Lorentz invariance. You very rarely want to give up unitarity, because it's something which is there's not a lot of freedom there to fool. End of time. an interesting thing that you have a massive spin one field, then it's a question of how light is it? It's a question of scale. So if you can't use a vector field if it's very heavy compared to the scales of the crisp, but if it's very, very light compared to the highest scales you think you understand, eventually it has to look like a massless particle. And so that leads you to gauging variance of the light particles. So let's start with scalar fields, spin zero particles. So another aside from this is that in the old days, they used to, not so much anymore, but in the 80s, you used to still see papers where people would talk about maybe we should describe the neutrino not in terms of spin half spinner field, but some other thing in the category of solutions there. And they're all derivative of each other, so there's really no physics. It's a change of variables, and the changes of variables do nothing physically. And so there's a kind of literature that you can afford to ignore, which they're essentially using different variables to describe the same physics, but looking for new physics in that choice, and that doesn't make any sense. For spin zero. The simplest case, so you might use the simplest case. The simplest case in that case is the scalar field.
Field representation.
Scalar field just transforms in this rule D is 1. So
U pi of x, U star is just pi of 1 of x. So the point you're looking at changes, but the field itself is what that changes.
So you can use one field to describe one particle. If you have more than one field, then they each separately transform and they don't care what the other one's doing. So in that case, I can tell you what the U's and the V's are. The U's and V's in that case are essentially 1 up to normalization. And there's a normalization issue, remember, to do with momenta. That we had a choice. If we chose to normalize states using a delta function, then that means that the creation annihilation operators also satisfy an algebra, so that A P sigma, A star, P prime, sigma prime. We don't have a sigma for spindle, so it's just. So that was, these were related choices, and if I had done it, I can't remember what I used as a symbol here, but if I did the Lorentz covariant choice, so I had 2 pi, Q, twice the energy. And that corresponds to these A's satisfying something similar on the right-hand side here. And so that normalization is going to feed into here. We have a choice as to what we do in this sum.
Can I clarify your question?
Yeah.
So sometimes you write P as a vector to specify only the space components of P.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think you're not using it well.
I'm frankly in particular for subscripts of A, I don't use it that way, but I still mean the space components of P.
Basically, I'm looking at these matrix elements here. And in this particular case, these are 4 vectors and not 3 vectors.
Here it's 3 vectors.
Okay, that's
good. So it's states are basically, that's because states are labeled by 3 vectors and spin, let's say. And then the energy is always dictated by Lorentz invariance. So the energy in this case is always the square root of p squared plus m squared. And m doesn't change as you do Lorentz transformation. So it's not labeled in states within a representation. It might be labeled in different representations. So the different particles be labeled by different masses, say. But within one representation, the thing that takes you through different states for a given representation are free momentum and spin. In the same way that an angular momentum, the third component of angular momentum is varying in the representation, but it's labeled by J. So M would be like J, but P and sigma are like little j, or whatever you call it. And so because the states are labeled by that, the creation relation operators are also labeled by that. So when I write a P or sigma there, it means this. If you want to make a 4 vector, you can always put 3 because you know what the energy is. And you know the momentum. But it might depend on mass, so you might have a different energy, a different field, different energies with mass. it's mostly it's the context. I'm kind of less will write the arrows because the context is going to give you the API objects are both four vectors because the whole thing was Lorentz operator. But and when I write out the PX in terms of three vectors, I'll try and write the vectors explicitly. But it's at some point the arrows become, you know, I forget them. It's also true that they put it up to the front of us. But ask if you're not sure what it is. So the point of this exercise is going to be that what we write for the fields for these U's and V's is going to, it was determined by normalization. Now I'm telling you what normalization. And the normalization will have or not have factors of this depending on which of these choices we make for the eights. So the right hand side there. So in the book uses this choice. But in class, I'm going to use this choice because this is the one that I grew up with. That's the one that would be natural if there's coming from another, you know, we're doing this from coming from a non-relativist background. So with this choice, so in this case, now we're talking about spinless fields. Telling me this is another way of saying that U and V are given by. Let's call this case A, case B. In case A, U and V are just given by 1 over the square root 2 pi cubed twice the energy. In case B, U and V are given by 1 over 2 pi cubed twice the energy. So in this case, you have 5x. For any given type of particle, you'd be given by, there's no spins to sum, so there's no sum or sigma, integral of d3p over the square root of 2 pi. 2 pi's are all conventional, I'm just giving you a convenient one that's normally used. This is with the energy dependence is dictated by the normalization. Then you have e to the I of dx, a of t, and if there's more than one kind of particle, it's up for t. And then, here we have e to the minus 1 of dx, the antiparticle, negative 1 of e. So here we would have had no square root of this. Let me put hats on this just so it's sufficiently clear which is which. So this is transforming like a Lorentz scalar, because this was transforming like a Lorentz scalar, basically. And this is Lorentz curve. That was the point of these normalizations.
I'm sorry, just a question. Is it possible that the A and B are inverse to E and B in these two? I mean, I'm not sure if they're just
where?
Heuristically. The conventions for the U and V.
The A's and B's, you mean the...
Like just the... Shouldn't A be B and B be A? I don't know what you're looking at here, so what line are you pointing to? So in this thing, we have more like the power of B in the denominator, and B is bigger.
Yeah.
Right? And so then when you take the commutator, you'd expect to have more E's in the denominator, which is the opposite in your other convention, A and B.
You're wondering if maybe this should be the square root, this not the square root?
Yeah.
No, that's basically the way to think of this is that I could get the A hats from the A's by multiplying them by the square root of
okay, yeah, right. I'm sorry, I thought about this wrong.
Well, this is probably what you're thinking of, because I'm thinking about it. So if I take this to be that times the square root, I would remove the two. So these states are obtained from these states by multiplying them by p round p is square root of stuff. Nice. destroy this thing, or this thing is made by creating from the nil particle state using a creation operator. So that means that the A hats on them should be square root of something times the A's. And now you're saying that I go over there.
No, no, I was wrong.
Oh, no, this works. Yeah, good. Yeah, right. So that's one way of thinking of how to make a translation. So when you look at the what you're going to find when I give you the book, it's using B. And so don't get thrown off by, I'm going to use A in these lectures, because if I don't, I'm going to always be making mistakes with the square roots, because I'm just used to doing it one way. And it's one of those things that if you start changing that, if you'd like, then you know how to price this. Yeah?
Just to remind you what the A bars are.
A bars are, to get the whole story of, like, to get the Lagrangian density to commute, that's based on separations, I was not allowed to use just, and I believe you could just stop with the Fourier transform of A. But that, if I did that, the fields don't commute with them, so that they're complex conjugates at space-like separations, so not into the Lagrangian. And so observables won't commute at space-like separations, so I can't separately measure things that are independently, should be independent. And the way to fix that was, the only known way to fix that was to take everywhere I have a particle, suppose that I have another particle with exactly the same mass, and the mass plays a role because the energy is in those p's, and add to it something I didn't write here properly. Add to it the complex conjugate. And this has the property that getting the same mass, that I think phi with phi star or phi with phi, you'll always commute the space-like separations because the A bar is going to cancel the A's. The A bar won't commute with A bar star, and A won't commute with A star, in a way which depends on the mass. If the mass is the same, you can make those two expense each other. And then everything will commute the space-like separation.
So what are the communication relations between A's and A bar?
Those ones. Oh, A's and A bars is zero, so those are different particles.
Oh.
If they're different, you have a choice. If A bar is different from A, then they just like different particles of A commute for the end of A. But if they're, it could be that the particle is its own antiparticle, in which case then A bar is A, and then they won't commute. But the important thing for the logic up here that I'm actually glossing over and not doing the detail is that they, A with A star is commute, A with A bar with A bar is particle. Okay. So you can see that if A bar were equal to A, so then phi would be equal to phi star. If my complex conjugate this, all I'm going to do is I'm going to take these things consistent. And that will be the same thing if A and A bar are the same operator, but they won't be if these are different particles of A and A bar. Now what I'm going to do, there's two separate, so it sounds like there's a physics question here, in whether or not fields are real or not. And it's true that there will be a physics question if the thing describing particles you actually see, so mass eigenstates, are real or not. That's a physical question. But when we're describing what the Lagrangian is, or the Hamiltonian is, that is a thing we're using to describe the properties, we have an option of whether or not we can always choose to use real fields, and it's not. And we're not saying that if you use real fields, if you assume you're using real fields, you are not saying that particles have to be equal to antiparticles, because although that sounds funny, that's because supposing we have particles that are not equal to antiparticles, I could always take the real part of this field. I could define phi plus phi star, call that phi 1. Then I get the imaginary part, phi minus phi star over I, call that phi 2. And instead of using one complex field, I could use two real fields. And I've not done anything, it's just a change of variables. And so there's no loss of generality in describing a system of particles with real fields, as long as you're open-minded about how many of the real fields you have. So what I'm going to do is I want to write down the most general possible Lagrangian for non-interacting systems spinless particles. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down the most general thing. I want to know what the most general thing is, and so I want to make sure I've exhausted all the possibilities. And so one of the possibilities will be, one of the questions will be, well, is the Hamiltonian Hermitian or not? And so I want to be able to ask what the choices are I have to make the Hamiltonian Hermitian. It will be convenient to do that analysis using real variables. So I'm going to look at a system of n particles, and I'm going to describe that, or I'm going to look at a system of n fields, and I'm going to leave n open. And you shouldn't be worried that I'm making some sort of a physical choice about whether particles are the same as antiparticles. Because if particles were different from the antiparticles, what we would find is when we finish with the Hamiltonian and we diagonalize everything, we found what the masses are, there would be two different species of particles with a given mass. There's a particle with any particle. And if I find there's only one species of particle with a given mass, then it has to be equal to any particle, because any particle has to have the same mass. The content of this, that top left board, is that we were not allowed to do what you do in non-relativistic physics, and have fields which are fields with A's only and not A's stars. The existence of two different kinds of particles, the same kind of particles, is secondary to the statement that we have to always have things built up A equals A star. That's the thing that the interactions have to always depend on in order to be commuting as base-like separation. So I don't know how obscure that was for you, but claim is there is no loss in generality. In using only real fields, provided you use enough of them. So, for example, given a phi that's not real, define phi 1 to be 5 plus 5 star, phi 2 to be phi minus 5 star over I. And those are two real fields that are describing the same physics as phi plus 5.
Meaning given phi not.
Sorry?
Given phi not.
Oh, yeah, they're right. Given phi not 5 star. Might be an expensive day, I don't know how it is. I have a credit card, but I can't pull that. Alright, no, we're in business. Who's that? Is that you? You?
Alright.
Let me do this next line, and then we can take a break to see if there's any bagels up there. So, what is the most general term of phi and the derivative? Which corresponds to what we have for the free Hamiltonian. So, to n zenith particles. And for that, remember the Hamiltonian we know, the constant plus the, if the spinless is the sum over the particle types, and P3P of the energy density, or the energy, or type I, the spin was a no spin. I'm putting that downstairs here, but that's the part of the label. And I guess I'll have to use A. That's what I used before. And the energy here can depend on the particle type only through the mass. The Lorentz transformations, Lorentz invariance of energy, p squared equals m squared. The m squared could depend on which particle we're talking about. So the bottom line is we're looking for something, you know, what's the key thing with H? H is quadratic in A. So the thought for the day, notice H naught is quadratic. And phi is linear. If I'm going to try and build something, also the connection between H and L is linear. Remember, H and L, the way I get H from L is I take, I find the momenta, and I get the momenta by differentiating L, respect to phi dot, and then I add, I multiply the momenta by phi, and then I subtract the Lagrangian. So the connection between H and L is linear. So if I want to build something enrolling phis in L and get something at the end of the day, which is quadratic in the A's, once I've substituted in the expression for phi in terms of A. So here's the phi in terms of A. Phi is linear in A. If the answer is quadratic in A, this thing has to be a most quadratic in the field. So the bottom line is, the class of things I have to be looking at to get something of this form has to be quadratic at most in the fields. So what I'm really asking here is, what's the most general L which I can have, which is quadratic in the fields, and which satisfies all these other things that we have? This has to be a Lorentz scalar, and it has to give me an energy which is bounded from below, because these things are all bounded from below, and so on. The action to be Lorentz invariant, that's that we wanted the whole thing to be Lorentz invariant, and we wanted it to be Hermitian. We want that because we want the Hamiltonian to be Hermitian, because that's unitarity. And we also ask H not to be bounded from below. We want a minimum energy state somewhere. In the free case, we're thinking of no particles there. So that's a 1, 2, 3, and 4. Now this is why it's useful to think in terms of fields that are representative of the Lorentz group. It's a lot easier to think about what the position of the Lorentz scalar is if you're building it on a Lorentz scalar. So let's, what can we write? We can write down constant A. That certainly satisfies all those things. It's at most, I should say, at most quadratic. We don't have, not everything's quadratic here, right? That's not correct. We could write down something which is linear in fields. If we're going to have things that are less than quadratic, so we have B times phi. And if we have more than one field, we can sum over A. You might imagine trying to write down a derivative of d mu phi with some coefficient c mu. But this is not going to be Lorentz correct, because if I do a Lorentz transformation, on L, and this is an operator, I think u, u, u star, u is going to sail through all the constants, not even a c them. And it's going to do a Lorentz transformation here, but we're not going to have a corresponding Lorentz transformation here. So this looks like it's Lorentz invariant because there's two vectors in bracket. This is not a vector from the point of view of what happens when you do a Lorentz transformation. We want this to be satisfying. If I do a Lorentz transformation, position x changes, but nothing else does. So this is like a scalar field too. So this is something which I can hold out on the grounds of Lorentz invariance. So not Lorentz invariant. It's also something which I have another reason not to think about, because it's a total derivative. If I integrate this, what I'm going to do is calculate the Hamiltonian from the action. So I'm going to take this and I'm going to integrate it over all space. But if I integrate over all space, the integral of derivative is going to give me something which depends on boundaries. And so because L is a total derivative, if I calculate the canonical momentum from this, it'll be zero, because I'm varying the fields. I'm trying to see how this thing changes if I change the field, the time derivative of the field. But it doesn't depend on the time derivative of the field anywhere except on the boundary. So the integral of L d for x. And so drops out of has a caveat. You have to worry about boundary conditions in some cases, and so I'm being kind of sloppy about the boundary conditions. But for everything we're going to do with perturbation theory, what I'm telling you is true.
Mind your boundary conditions.
There are situations in life where you have to care about boundary conditions, and then that's, this kind of stuff I'm doing now, you have to be more careful about. But for now, it's all right. What has two derivatives, or two fields? So I can just write down phi A, phi B, with some matrix in front of it. So A, B, I'll call it D, A, B. So this is sum over A and B. That's a scalar, phi is a scalar. You could have something with two fields and one derivative. You might hope you could have E, U, A, B, phi A, E, U, phi B. But this is, again, not a Lorentz invariant in this sense. It doesn't satisfy this, because if these E's are non-zero, if I do Lorentz transformation, I'll get a Lorentz transformation of this, but not of this, because these operators U and U star go through, then we can see these E's. So I can drop that. I have F, A, B, maybe if you're, you all know that what I mean here is it's d dx mu. So d0 is particle x0, which is dt. And d space is particle x space, which is trad. And when I raise an index and lower an index, that's symmetric. So d mu phi. E mu phi is a to mu nu, e mu phi, e mu phi. So that's minus phi dot squared plus grad phi squared. Yeah.
So does the fact that third term in L is a total derivative, does that imply that we must drop it or that we have the freedom to drop it?
If all that was wrong with it, it was a total derivative, and the examples that we will have, which are Lorentz invariant, which aren't total derivatives, then if you kept it, then you find that you never had anything that depended on it, unless you would ask a physical question that depended on the boundary conditions. So then it's kind of pointless to keep it because it's never actually something. It's a special case of what's called a redundant operator, something which is, if you keep demanding these operators, what happens is that you'll find that ultimately you'd like to read off from some physical observable what the values of these coefficients are. But you'll find that if you have a redundant operator, nothing physical depends on this coefficient, so you can never fix it. But you don't care because nothing physical depends on it. So you might have to do it. Want to take a cookie break now, or? It's easy for me to go for the whole hour and a half. I can't remember how hard it is to do an hour and a half lecture. Unless your brain is floating or something. You need some sugar?
You're supposed to stop at 45 minutes.
In our
psychology studies, and people's attention spans drop after 45 minutes.
Yeah. So do you want to do that? Do you want to take a break for sugar? Okay. I don't know if there's sugar there for sure. We'll take a look at another. There's always coffee. And when you come back here at 12, so just 4 minutes.